Well, as you pointed out, FDA is critically important to every single American. It regulates 25 cents of every dollar that Americans spend. And, of course, the most important things we spend our money on are the food we eat and the drugs and medical devices that we depend upon to save our lives. And right now, Congress is presently reauthorizing the fees that companies contribute for the review of these medical products. And so it's a critical time to address, do we have the regulatory processes and an agency in place that's able to address the amazing challenges that we're facing today to stay at the forefront of biomedical research and bring these products to patients?
Is the issue that it takes too long? I mean, you must have some hunch as to what sorts of reforms might be needed.
Well, when I was commissioner in 2006 and Congress was going through reauthorization, a great deal of concern at that time was about the safety of our medical products and of our food. And Congress, of course, was able to give the FDA authorities to increase its ability of oversight for safety. I think today, the biggest concern that's on people's minds is that the regulatory process itself needs to be modernized and, if you will, streamlined, because the longer it takes to bring these products to patients, then the fewer lives are saved. But most importantly, the huge economic costs that then are associated with the process can basically cripple Americans' leadership in this field.
What exactly needs to change internally at the FDA to make this work?
One of the most important things people have been focusing on is the agency needs the resources. It needs the people, and those people need to be properly trained and, most importantly, be given the modern scientific tools to be able to really make insightful decisions about the safety and the efficacy of these and effectiveness of these products. But more importantly than just the resources, I believe, is the fact that we need to look at the entire regulatory infrastructure and reassess it from the point of view, is it capable of dealing with the complexity of the kind of products that are being developed? We're seeing amazing progress in fields like regenerative medicine, new technologies being instituted, like nanotechnologies. And the agency needs the scientific infrastructure. It needs to have the right scientific processes in place to make rapid and efficient, but also wise and safe decisions about these products, because we've got to get them to patients much sooner and much quicker because lives are at stake.
So what is your take? Is it capable of dealing with all of these puzzle pieces?
It's going to need congressional support and, in fact, congressional mandates. If we look back, 20 years ago, we faced an AIDS crisis, and at that time, the FDA was able to make a major step forward by creating a regulatory pathway called accelerated approval, and it was able to bring these life-saving drugs to AIDS patients much more rapidly. 15 years ago, when cancer was a major problem and we were seeing tremendous progress in the development of therapies for cancer, the FDA put a regulatory pathway in that was called Fast Track. And those two processes have been very effective in those areas. But the problem is that's 20 and 15 years ago. And rather than being the exception to the rule today, they need to be the routine way that we bring life-saving treatments for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and modern therapies for diabetes and all the rest.
We're speaking with Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach, the former FDA commissioner, now working on a project for the Manhattan Institute to modernize the FDA. Is one of the problems too much emphasis, and this is a difficult thing to say, but too much emphasis on safety, such that what used to take maybe a couple of years now takes maybe many more years longer and at greater expense just to make sure that there's no possible risk whatsoever with a drug, which might be an impossible goal anyhow?
Well, the greater complexity of these products, the kind of drugs and devices that are now being produced because of the tremendous progress in science and technology, that additional complexity puts a great deal of burden on the agency, if you will, to get it right. And so there is the tendency for it to be more cautious and slower in order to be certain that it's affecting or not adversely affecting safety. But the problem is that what we need to do is not continue to tweak the past, but to create a future. we need to be as innovative with regard to regulation as we're being innovative with regard to development of these products. And I don't believe that it has to be a trade-off between safety and effectiveness. We're able to now understand the biology of how many of these new drugs and biologics and devices work. And therefore, as we understand that and we understand their safety, we're also understanding their effectiveness from a mechanism point of view. That can allow the agency to be able to make much earlier and better decisions to bring those products into the marketplace. At the same time, we don't want to completely ignore them. And being able to now use modern tools of information technology and do post-market surveillance continues to give both the American people and the regulators an additional safety net. So if we're willing to embrace these new strategies of how to regulate these products, then we can bring them quicker and more rapidly to patients who desperately need them while not sacrificing safety.
So it sounds like you almost envision, for example, computer modeling of the way some molecules might work rather than long, expensive clinical tests and then get it out there and then follow up later on to see how it really works.
Absolutely. You said it better than I did, that we can now embrace these modern technologies and we can, in fact, be even more successful and continue to maintain the Food and Drug Administration as the gold standard in the 21st century, as it always has been in the 20th century. And the people at the agency are phenomenal. They're the best that we could ever hope for, both in terms of their commitment and their talent. What they need and what Congress needs to address in this reauthorization process is giving it the infrastructure, the tools, the authorities to really be able to bring the regulatory framework up to a level that's commensurate with what science and technology is doing at NIH and in industries and in academic institutions all over the world with regard to research and development.
What, if any, dialogue have you had with the FDA about this, and what happens next for the project you're working on?
Well, I believe Dr. Hamburg and I have a great relationship. I don't go back into the agency and interfere in any way. But at the same time, I think all of us have a responsibility, whether we're at the agency today or whether we were formerly a part of the agency, because we have an intimate understanding and knowledge of the challenges, but also the opportunities, to continue to work collaboratively and contribute. So we keep an open dialogue, and at the same time, I am able to contribute in an independent way since I'm no longer a part of the agency.
And when you come up with the conclusions, the Manhattan Institute finishes the survey, what will you do with them? Will you present it to Congress, to the FDA, and what will happen?
Well, we're disseminating things as we develop them, and also we're collaborating and cooperating with others. For example, the Center for Health Transformation just this past week released an in-depth report with regard to major changes that could be considered. There is legislation that's on the Hill currently that's being considered that not only reauthorizes the user fees, but also suggest major changes in the structure and function of the agency. And so we intend to contribute to that dialogue and to bring an informed and an insightful level of insight into the process.
Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach is the former FDA commissioner, now working at the Manhattan Institute. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll have to have you back for a progress report.
Well, I look forward to that, and thank you very much for your interest in what's of critical importance to the American people today, and for our safety of these drugs, for their effectiveness in saving lives, and most importantly, for assuring that the United States stays at the forefront of biomedical research and secures our economy in what will be the 21st century of the life sciences.
All right, Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach. We'll post this interview later this morning, and you can find more information on the Manhattan Institute's project, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. It's 8:18, still to come on Federal News Radio. Your cybersecurity update, NASA showing how secure ID cards could be used in the cloud on Ask the CIO. We'll have details. But first, Washington insiders forecast a choppy road ahead for the White House's plan to merge trade and commerce agencies. Reporter Emily Kopp has more. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Experience GW basketball in one of D.C.'s best college venues, the Colonials Club. As a member of the Colonials Club, you will enjoy a game day atmosphere that is unmatched in Washington area college basketball. Your philanthropic donation and loyal support for GW Athletics provides countless opportunities to our student athletes in pursuit of both their academic and athletic goals. Call 202-994-7325 to join the Colonials Club today and help raise high the Buff and Blue.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070, ackermansecurity.com.
Navy Rear Admiral retired Elizabeth A. Height, Vice President, U.S. Public Sector Cybersecurity Practice, HP Enterprise Services, on the Cybersecurity Combating Threats to Our Software Environment panel, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard.
We look at applications and software development from an architectural view today. At least we should, because quite frankly, it's so much easier to design security in than to find the thousands or tens of thousands of vulnerabilities that might exist in that software at a later date once deployed.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective, and that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help government secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. To learn more, visit federalnewsradio.com/HP.
Register now for AFSEA's 11th Annual Homeland Security Event, February 28th through March 1st at the Reagan Center. Focusing on vigilance during challenging times, doing more without more, this is the venue where you will hear firsthand about the critical IT issues facing our country in the fight against terrorism. This event is proudly sponsored by AT&T, Booz Allen Hamilton, CenturyLink, General Dynamics, InfoZen, NJVC, Kinetic North America, SAIC, and Verizon, and features speakers from all levels of government, military, and industry. Panelists from across the Homeland Security enterprise will dialogue on border security, cyberspace, immigration, disaster response, doing business with DHS, and other critical issues. Contractors and agencies will showcase the latest security products and solutions in the exposition. Register to attend or exhibit at afcea.org, keyword homeland. That's afcea.org.
8:21, it's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest co-host this morning is Ruben Gomez.
Washington insiders are forecasting a choppy road ahead for the White House's plan to merge six trade and business-focused agencies into one mega commerce department. That's the conclusion of four panelists who debated the merits of the proposed merger at the American Enterprise Institute, Free Market Washington think tank.
The panelists, from academia to business, agree there's waste and confusion among the six agencies now. Center for American Progress fellows Jatinder Kohli has researched the dysfunction.
Implementation of policies to safeguard the future prosperity of this nation or competitiveness are enormously fragmented compared to any other country you can think of. It is hard to think of another industrialized nation which has so many agencies with their fingers in the pie of trying to make their country successful for the long term.
The way he describes it, each agency is pointing to another one, saying they're the ones responsible for the country's economic policy as a whole, not us. John Murphy is Vice President of International Affairs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he agrees there's room for improvement.
There certainly is duplication among some of the activities of these different agencies, particularly on the trade promotion side of the equation, as opposed to trade liberalization. This is a question that's worth close examination, and if the finding is positive, a plan should be developed. But to date, we don't even see what this plan would be.
The White House last week sent a letter to Congress formally asking for the authority to consolidate and reorganize federal agencies. It says that creating a single agency to help businesses, particularly smaller ones, succeed would be the president's first task. But the Chamber of Commerce is wary. It singles out the potential merger of the U.S. Trade Representative with the other agencies as the most damaging thing about the idea.
When the administration comes along and says, well, we would like to move USTR and subsume it under these trade promotion functions, that means that the trade liberalizing function, which the business community regards as very important, where we have a lot of priorities that we'd like to talk about, is not going to be well served.
So if this White House plan isn't the solution to businesses' trade problems, what is? Murphy says the agencies can do a lot better now.
Additional resources would be a good beginning. In addition to that, the longstanding practice of seconding staff from other agencies to USTR maybe should be used more aggressively as needed. In fact, though, it's not reorganization per se that's needed, but a rethink of the interagency process. We need to examine how best to coordinate international economic policy across agencies.
Providing more resources and staff may seem like a more palatable solution than uprooting and mixing six agencies, but Coley says it's not a very practical one.
Didn't you get the memo? There actually isn't that much money flowing around. It's very easy to argue for small amounts of additional money in every corner of government. It's very hard to make the big decisions on how you actually make government work better for the long term. But I kind of feel that burning platform, if it hasn't burnt yet, it's sort of burning away. And someone needs to jump soon.
And Coley knows from experience. During Gordon Brown's administration in Britain, he oversaw a small but powerful regulatory agency, a boutique of sorts, that is, until it became part of a bigger agency focused on competitiveness.
This was not an easy thing for us to do, but actually having somewhere in the British government responsible for competitiveness, and people could bang their hands on the cabinet table and say, this is really important to us and this is the right way to make policy, actually that mattered.
He says productivity rose slightly after the merger and poured a few billion pounds into the British economy. But that sort of thing is unlikely to happen here, at least for a while. Lawmakers are reluctant to deal with such a thorny issue during an election year. Harvard Kennedy School lecturer Craig Van Grasdyck says that's okay. The who and what are more important than the where.
What's much more important than how we organize the boxes, people should be good. We should have good people running agencies. I think they also have to be empowered. Unless and until USTR in any guise and in any organization has in hand fast-track negotiating authority, a lot of what we're talking about here is spinning our wheels.
That authority expired in 2007. Obama comes from a manufacturing state where many view trade agreements with skepticism. When he ran for president, he promised not to seek renewal of the fast-track trade negotiating process. So far, he's kept his word. In Washington, Emily Kopp, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And go to federalnewsradio.com to read the White House's letter to Congress making the case for merging the six agencies. It's 8:26, still to come on Federal News Radio, your cybersecurity update. NASA showing how secure ID cards could be used in the cloud on Ask the CIO. We have the details. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Here's Roberta Stempfli, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Cybersecurity, Department of Homeland Security, on the Federal Executive Forum on Cybersecurity, sponsored by HP Enterprise Security.
We have to have the kind of interoperability between all of these pieces, right? The devices, the people, the organizations, the processes, to enable us to be able to work all of this complex system together in a way that's understandable.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Worried about cyber attacks, cyber espionage, and advanced persistent threats? HP Enterprise Security, powered by ArcSight, Tipping Point, and Fortify Solutions, gives you 360-degree security monitoring, enabling you to detect incidents, proactively test security to protect applications, and block attacks with adaptive network defenses. It has platform integration to help manage your agency's risk. Learn about HP Enterprise Security Solutions, powered by ArcSight, Tipping Point, and Fortify. Visit HPEnterpriseSecurity.com.
WashingtonCaps.com is the destination for behind-the-scenes coverage of your Washington Capitals. Get the most comprehensive Caps coverage with in-depth previews and analysis for every game, and blog, Twitter, and Facebook updates all day, every day. Check out Caps 365, where you can view all the best goals, saves, and hits, and access exclusive player interviews, press conferences, and much more. Check it all out on WashingtonCaps.com and do your part in building America's hockey capital.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, nutrition, dietary supplements, herbal remedies, and more. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit myvillagegreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Megafood and Gero Formulas.
Max out your privacy settings on social networks. Restrict as much as you can what people can see of you. Close all your old accounts. Chances are it's got an email that you've reused. They could guess the maiden name of your mother or your first pet or something.
Yeah.
A lot of the celebrities whose email accounts were hacked, their challenge question was something that you could look up on the internet.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Profile America, Thursday, February 23rd. There are many bird feeding and bird watching events this month. One of them is the annual Great Backyard Bird Count, in which ordinary Americans note the kinds and quantity of birds in their immediate area, helping scientists to track the health of the bird population. With the foliage off the trees, many will be looking at and photographing birds with cameras and binoculars. It was this month in 1872 that the first state bird sanctuary was established at Oakland, California's Lake Merritt. It was named for the mayor who started the efforts to preserve the lake. In the U.S. today, nearly 14 million people enjoy bird watching, and 55.5 million feed the birds and other wildlife in their area. You can find more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
Government IT acquisition professionals get the knowledge you need to meet today's serious challenges. Join over 500 government and industry colleagues at Acquisition Excellence, March 29th at the Grand Hyatt downtown. This education and training event is presented by the General Services Administration and the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council. Registration is limited, so don't wait. Register today at actgov.org. That's actgov.org. Look for the Acquisition Excellence link on the events page.
8:30, it's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio 1500M. My guest host this morning is Ruben Gomez.
And now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update. The morning's at 30 minutes past the hour. NASA is testing how employees can use their secure identity cards under Homeland Security Presidential Directive 12 to log on to cloud services. Linda Curtin is the NASA Chief Information Officer. She tells reporter Jason Miller about the space agency's identity management pilot with Google Apps.
The pilot has been more successful than we imagined. And we've gotten a lot of pressure from our customers. Hey, can we do this? Hey, we can do that. And so we said, okay, we're going to do the pilot. And we've had a tremendous amount of interest in people wanting to be in the pilot. Our latest pilot has about 500 people in it. And it's been tremendously successful. We're trying to, in there, look at integrating Google with our authentication infrastructure so that we address a lot of the fears and concerns that people have in doing things like this, like, oh, well, it's not secure. So I think we're pretty much going to look at it and from a risk-based perspective and just start tackling it and getting to that. The big benefit, though, is the capability that's delivered with being able to edit documents simultaneously. People want to do that. And people want to be able to have a lot of the apps that are available there. So giving our end users that kind of capability and that kind of diversity is a big win for us. The final area that's very important is with Google Sites. And this is, I'm not trying to be a commercial for Google, but this is just what's in our pilot. You know, there's that the .gov reform. before you ask, I'll tell you. So we're like the high rollers, NASA is, relative to websites. We've got websites. We've got oodles of websites. So we want to get some more management of that. And that the websites provide kind of a big attack surface from an IT security perspective. So we have that, yet we have scientists who collaborate a lot with their peers that are everywhere in universities and other space agencies and that kind of thing. So we can't shut down the ability to collaborate from the scientists. So how do you do that and do it securely? So one of the things we're looking at with Google Sites is to be able to provide that collaboration environment for scientists that can be more secure than some of the websites that we have that exist right now.
Let me step back for a sec on the Google Pilot. So these 500 people on the pilot are using their PIV cards to authenticate themselves to a mail system or a collaboration site. What is exactly happening?
We have a system that we call Launchpad that's sort of our, I don't want to call it single sign-on because everybody says, no, I got to do it. No, our reduced sign-on. How's that? So that you can go there and then you're authenticated in every place else you go. So you can get in there through a PIV card, or you can get in there the classic way with your password token kind of combination thing. So once you're there, then that authenticates you to get to the services that are connected, so to speak, to that. And that's where the pilot comes in with Google.
Is this for more than, so it's more than just email, but are you looking at going to an email in the cloud service eventually, use and having that HSPD-12 card part of that email as a service?
Under the ACES contract, one of the things that we're looking for is a modernization of our email infrastructure. And I think that a cloud is the answer to that, to provide that capability.
500 people so far in the pilot. How long is it going to last for? When? What comes next for it?
One of the, I guess, the innovator's dilemma is what do you do? And I always joke that pilot stands for put in live later on today. So there's no good way to get us from the pilot stage to how do you actually get it in production. So one of the things that Dr. Play will be looking at is how to do that. But we're not going to just cut off the user and say, whoop, it's done. But how do you incorporate that into the day-to-day operation? I do know that Google, they're having conversations with HP, our ACES service provider, and I fully expect that they'll come up with some creative ideas about how to do that transition.
NASA was ahead of a lot of agencies. You had the Nebula Cloud, kind of a private cloud. Give me the status of that, and what are some other cloud initiatives NASA is considering, testing, or actually put in production?
So, yeah, we were ahead. And the thing I mentioned earlier is that this industry moves like at the speed of light. That's a good speed for NASA, right? 186,000 miles per second. So the thing about being out ahead, sort of like what AOL did. AOL kind of came out in ahead, and then everybody else jumped in, and everything went like that. And so in a way, I fully expect that we'll see something like that where everybody jumps in and there's more. Putting the contribution out in OpenStack was very significant because that put us in a situation where we could get the capability more commercially. We didn't have to continue to do our own testing, development, and all that kind of stuff. We could work with the community to do it, and we could hope that industry would pick up the mantle and do it as they have been. So I think that where we're going to go in that from that perspective is to look more on obtaining services from commercial sources, whether it's industry or Amazon or Google or Microsoft or anything like that. They're starting to get more secure. They're starting to meet the requirements that we have as a federal government. All the reasons that we would have to continue to have a private cloud. One of the things that still lingers is how do we handle ITAR data and things like that. And I still think that there's a lot of progress that's being made in that. So the need to maintain a private cloud gets diminished as industry delivers more and more capability.
Linda Curitan is the NASA Chief Information Officer. She tells reporter Jason Miller about the space agency's efforts around cloud computing. You can listen to their entire interview later this morning at 10:30 or anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Tune in for your cybersecurity update mornings at 30 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's 8:37, still to come on Federal News Radio. A new postal service might learn a thing or two from the new auto industry. We'll hear insights from Senator Tom Carper of Delaware. And then a former commissioner has a new mission, Project FDA, to overhaul his old agency, or at least come up with recommendations for overhauling it. But first, your DOD report. Your TRICARE prescription benefit might look a lot different than it does today if the Pentagon gets its way. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
IT Challenge is a series exploring the administration's aim to fundamentally change how the federal government purchases and uses IT, and a discussion around one of the biggest goals, reducing the number of federal data centers by at least 40% by 2015. During the show, Doug Bourgeois, Vice President and Federal Chief Cloud Executive for VMware, commented,
"Virtualization abstracts the operating system and the data from the device. It provides a certain amount of agility and flexibility from a technological standpoint. Using virtualization and virtual desktop infrastructure to liberate the data from the endpoint device and bring it into the private cloud, that's key. The data in particular, it provides so much more flexibility for multiple devices to be mobile and geographically disparate and still have access to that data."
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware.
What is causing low morale at your agency, and what can managers do to fix it? Check out our special report, Managing Morale, Fixing the Problems Plaguing Your Federal Office, online at federalnewsradio.com. See the results of our exclusive survey on federal morale and hear what Congress expects of feds during these tough budget times. OPM Director John Barry tells us how he motivates employees, plus tips from leadership experts. Find it all at federalnewsradio.com. Search term morale.
The Department of Defense faces some big changes in the coming years. I'm Federal News Radio's DoD reporter, Jared Serbu. We help you track those changes every Wednesday afternoon from 2 to 3 with On DoD. Each week, we'll talk one-on-one with defense experts and senior managers about the policies, programs, and innovations that affect warfighters and how the military will continue to meet its mission. That's On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
8:40, it's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And now your Federal News Radio DoD report, mornings at 40 minutes past the hour. Local pharmacists and some lawmakers are concerned about how a proposed merger between two pharmacy benefit managers will affect the TRICARE system. But a spokesman for one of the companies involved in the merger says those concerns are unfounded. Mary Rosato is Vice President of Federal Government Affairs at Express Scripts. She tells Federal News Radio's Frances Rose she's excited about the potential merger because it will enhance capabilities on the clinical side and lower delivery costs.
We actually believe that this merger with Medco will accelerate those savings in the future for in terms of better clinical programs, better clinical outcomes, better health outcomes, and lower, hopefully lower drug costs. I mean, anyone who suggests this merger will raise costs is misguided in terms of the fact that the Department of Defense and the TRICARE program gets what you would call preferred pricing under the federal supply schedule. So it's really not an issue in terms of pricing in the contract. You know, I would also say that the Department of Defense, what they're really concerned about is the ability to have competition compete for these contracts. The last time I believe that this contract went out for bid, there were four other bidders, including Express Scripts. It might have been three, including Humana, CVS, United. I would note that Medco was not one of those bidders. And the Department of Defense has said as recently, I believe, as last week to media that they expect to get a similar number of competitive bids the next time they send this out or even more.
So it, in your view, it doesn't come down then the next time this is out for bids to just you in the event you merge with Medco. It's not just a matter of you versus CVS Caremark.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely.
What ultimately, though, whether you merge or not, what ultimately is the outcome for the person who is going to, however they get their prescriptions, through the mail or at a local pharmacy or a big chain or wherever, what's the ultimate outcome? What difference does it make to the person getting that prescription filled?
Well, for the current contract, it really doesn't make, in the short term, any change whatsoever. But the combined Express Scripts, Medco merger, we're not just combining our facilities, we're combining our clinical capabilities. And the goal and hope behind it is that the sum will be greater than its parts and will lead to better care coordination, more clinical services and offerings for beneficiaries.
One of the things that the representative of the National Community Pharmacists Association pointed out yesterday is a desire for more transparency on maximum allowable cost limits. What are you doing in the realm of that transparency, and why is more transparency there either a good or a bad idea in your view?
So first, let me start with the fact that the Department of Defense and Express Scripts, as their pharmacy contractor, pharmacy benefit manager contractor, has a totally transparent model and a totally transparent contract. Pharmacy networks in our, retail pharmacies in our networks do not have, their providers in our network. Our relationship is not with them. It is with the Department of Defense, and we have a totally transparent contract with them.
What overall should people be thinking about, or does this even matter to Mr. or Mrs. TRICARE recipient in the event that this merger goes through and the next time this comes around? Or is this just such a far-off thing that maybe it's not something that needs to be on the radar screen of the average TRICARE customer right now?
So I would start with the fact that nothing in terms of the current contract and the services that the department has contracted with Express Scripts to provide will change. That is a floor. I mean, I would assume that going forward, the merger, to the extent that it adds clinical capabilities that weren't there before, an ability to better manage care, complex care, such as multiple, patients with multiple sclerosis and the like, it actually has the ability to enhance patient care. But with respect to costs and with respect to network and access, no changes.
I appreciate the answers about TRICARE, and I'm curious, while I have you on the line, Mary Rosado's Vice President of Federal Government Affairs at Express Scripts, what are some of the other things that are on the radar screen of a company like yours at this point in time and when it pertains to the federal government?
Well, I mean, I think that the biggest thing on our horizon is that with whether you're looking at health reform, the Affordable Care Act, or, Department of Defense, et cetera, the government is a large payer of healthcare services, and they're looking for value. They're looking for lower costs. They're looking for better health outcomes. One of the reasons we think this merger is very strategic, in terms of in the future being able to deliver that not only for the Department of Defense, but also for other healthcare programs, whether they're funded by the federal government or the states.
Mary Rosado is Vice President of Federal Government Affairs at Express Scripts. You can hear this interview and read more about possible changes to TRICARE at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
It's 8:46. A revived Navy airship program has fallen victim to budget-cutting pressure. The military branch has mothballed its MZ-3A blimp based in New Jersey. Military Times reports the program doesn't have enough customers. Now, the Naval Research Lab was the last one, flying it to test intelligence and surveillance sensors. But that's over now. No one else needs to use the blimp, so the Navy is deflating it, putting it in storage, and to save on maintenance costs. The move could mean layoffs for the program's civilian contract crew.
I wonder if that means they recycle the helium.
Recycle helium.
I mean, isn't that what keeps those things up?
It
helium?
Is.
Helium's expensive.
Yeah.
And it's kind of in short supply. I think some brands or some styles of helium, there's different molecules. And that's about what I know about helium.
I just wonder how you do that.
Or they could just make the world's biggest children's party and blow up 10 million balloons with all the blimp helium. Tune in for your DoD report mornings at 40 minutes past the hour. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's 8:47. Still to come on Federal News Radio, a former commissioner has a new mission, Project FDA, to help overhaul his old agency. And then an immigration enforcement program is getting shot down by the Obama administration. But first, a new postal service might learn a thing or two from the new auto industry. We'll get insights from Senator Tom Carper of Delaware. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Powered by the latest second-generation Intel Xeon processors, new HP ProLiant G7 servers are a perfect high-speed solution for lowering costs, improving utilization, and reducing server sprawl. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how together they can power your data center into the future. Talk to GovConnection's experienced federal sales team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
Listen to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM every Friday morning at 11, brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Fed Talk features live interviews with guests from the federal community sharing their insights on issues that affect you. Call in or email questions or comments to fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Fed Talk is sponsored by GEICO. This week on Fed Talk, host Bill Bransford will be joined by the Federal Managers Association to learn about its upcoming annual conference and training.
Register now for AFSEA's 11th Annual Homeland Security Event, February 28th through March 1st at the Reagan Center. Focusing on vigilance during challenging times, doing more without more, this is the venue where you will hear firsthand about the critical IT issues facing our country in the fight against terrorism. This event is proudly sponsored by AT&T, Booz Allen Hamilton, CenturyLink, General Dynamics, InfoZen, NJVC, Kinetic North America, SAIC, and Verizon, and features speakers from all levels of government, military, and industry. Panelists from across the Homeland Security enterprise will dialogue on border security, cyberspace, immigration, disaster response, doing business with DHS, and other critical issues. Contractors and agencies will showcase the latest security products and solutions in the exposition. Register to attend or exhibit at afcea.org, keyword homeland. That's afcea.org.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is Arena Stage. Join Arena Stage Artistic Director Molly Smith and Gala Chair WUSA9's J.C. Hayward at the Golden Gala on Monday, March 26, featuring Broadway sensation Kate Baldwin and honoring Senators Thad Cochran and Patrick Leahy. This enchanted evening of dining, dancing, and entertainment benefits arts education programs at Arena Stage. For more information, visit federalnewsradio.com. The Community Spotlight is brought to you by Papa John's and Federal News Radio.
8:50, it's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest host this morning is Ruben Gomez, and before we get to Mr. Gomez's report, we just want to let you know we looked up helium-3 as the one that's in short supply, and that is because it's a byproduct of nuclear stockpile, which is shrinking, and that material is used in the detection of bombs. It's not the same helium used to keep blimps up. All right, Ruben.
All right. Now, the auto industry might be a model for a revamped, not bailed out postal service. Senator Tom Carper of Delaware is the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Federal Financial Management. He tells Federal News Radio's Francis Rose what he thinks of the Postal Service's plan to save money.
I think the direction that the Postal Service is heading, and perhaps the Senate with them, is to for the Postal Service to take a close look at several thousand post offices across the country out of some 33,000, and to see if in some communities where in some cases where the postmaster is being paid $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 and the post office is only generating $15,000 or $20,000 worth of postal business. The Postal Service, I think, is interested in engaging a number of those communities in a conversation. It doesn't say we're going to close your post office, but says we'd like to continue to provide the Postal Service in your community. But we'd like for you to consider some changes. One, they'd like to incentivize a number of postmasters to go ahead, who are eligible to retire, to go ahead and retire. And rather than paying a lot of money to a postmaster to run a post office that generates very little revenues, to offer service in that post office where maybe a retired postmaster could come in and work part-time. maybe the community would like to have mail service at that post office in the morning or and in the middle of the day or in the afternoon or some combination thereof. Or maybe the community would say, you know, we really don't care about having the post office there open. We have a supermarket down the road, and we'd like to have our post office in the supermarket. Or you might have a situation where you have rural letter carriers that are delivering mail out in the community, out in the countryside. And the rural letter carrier will say, you know, I stop at this place for gas or have my lunch every day, and I can just sell postage stamps and provide services right there 5 or 6 days a week. So the idea here is not for the Postal Service to mandate what they would do to try to rein in their costs but still provide postal service. But the idea would be to engage in a real conversation with the community, say, here's our 3 or 4 or 5 options, what works best for the community, have that conversation, and then make a decision accordingly.
One of the criticisms of that potential process is the fact that Congress would be so heavily involved in it. Is there a way to ensure that your colleagues would be able to step back and allow the Postal Service to have that conversation with the communities without feeling the need to step in?
Yeah, I don't know that the Congress needs to be intimately involved in that conversation. The idea is to make sure the Postal Service has a real conversation with the community. And the folks in that community say, well, given these 3 or 4 or 5 options, these are the 1 or 2 that work best for us. And at the end of the day, it's probably a role for the Postal Regulatory Commission to examine what's and end up being sort of agreed to, and to try to make sure that's a reasonable standard of service in that community. So I actually think this might work. We'll see. I think that's might be the direction we're headed.
I was recently in your state and driving across Route 16 to get to the beach, and we drove through a little town called Ellendale, and there is a grocery store there. And as I drove through and saw the post office, and then we went like 3 minutes later, and I will, for the record, say I was driving the speed limit of 25 miles an hour through town, so I don't want the authorities in Ellendale to suspect that I was maybe one of the Marylanders trying to get away with something there. But as I noticed that juxtaposition of the post office and the grocery store that's right on the main street, it's maybe a difference of a couple hundred yards for someone to access that location. It sounds like that's what you're talking about as potential alternative locations in small towns where that might not sustain a full-blown post office anymore.
It's possible that a community that did have a grocery store or a supermarket or a pharmacy or a convenience store that's open maybe 7 days a week and maybe even 24 hours a day, for that community to say, you know, we'd be happy to have the post office in the supermarket. One of several grocery stores that we use in northern Delaware has in the grocery store they have a bank, they've got a pharmacy, and the idea of having a post office there, that might work for a lot of people as well.
Now, you mentioned that you want to pay attention to where the Postal Service is headed and where the Senate may go also. I'm paraphrasing what you said earlier. But I wonder if that is the actual dynamic that you would like to see, is that Congress can go to the Postal Service and say, we are comfortable with your plan, we're confident that this plan is going to take you in the right direction, and so you go and get the results that you think are appropriate. Is that where you are right now with the Postal Service's plan?
Yeah, the Postal Service needs to be able to continue to provide reasonably good service, acceptable service, if you will, to communities across the country. And they need to be able to do it in a way that's more cost-effective and to not save billions of dollars a year, but to save some real money. The Postal Service is they've just about used up their $15 billion line of credit with the federal government. They're on tab to run up another $10 billion or so this year. They just can't continue on that path. So we have to find ways for the Postal Service to save money. They have to find ways, and we have to find ways to grow revenues. So I think there's a way here to continue to provide service, good service in the communities, with respect to the way that that particular community would think is appropriate, and at the same time to do it in a way that's more cost-effective for the Postal Service.
Delaware Senator Tom Carper, chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. You can hear the entire interview at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It is 8:56. Still to come on Federal News Radio, an immigration enforcement program is getting shot down by the administration. But first, a former commissioner has a new mission, Project FDA, to overhaul his old agency. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
What bills in Congress could affect your pay, benefits, and agency budgets? Federal News Radio's Bill Tracker follows them all. Find it at federalnewsradio.com, search term Bill Tracker.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Federal agencies rely on EMC solutions to provide storage management and lower costs. Many EMC resellers are turning to Immix Group as their preferred federal distributor of EMC products. As the only EMC distributor that's local and focused exclusively on the public sector, Immix Group can help IT solution providers market EMC's products more effectively and grow their federal sales. Learn how you can select Immix Group as your federal distributor for EMC products. Visit emcgov.com. That's emcgov.com.
Dude, check out my new Pioneer DEH44 car stereo with built-in HD radio technology and new HD2 HD3 channels.
HD2 HD3 channels?
Get with it, man. HD2 HD3 channels are all these new free digital radio channels.
How do I listen to them?
With the new Pioneer DEH44 HD radio receiver. It's only $120 at Walmart.
Walmart? That's cool.
Yeah, just go to HDradio.com and check out the station guide. They're adding new channels all the time.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics.
See it in